and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's threat to slap a 5% tariff on all Mexican exports entering the U.S. starting on Monday, unless talks underway in Washington come up with a solution to Trump's demand that Mexico stop what the U.S. has failed to do so far, and that is stop immigrants crossing the United States southern border. John Mill Ackerman joins us from Mexico City, where he's a columnist for the daily newspaper La Jornada and the weekly magazine Proceso. We'll discuss the pressure Mexico's President López Obrador is under to not appear to be obsequious while trying to maintain his paz y amor, peace and love, policy with Trump, who is continually baiting Mexico as he keeps returning to the border as a winning issue to rile up his base. We will assess whether the deployment of 6,000 Mexican troops on the notoriously porous border with Guatemala will make a difference, and whether Trump's tariffs, which will quickly escalate to 25%, will devastate the Mexican economy and trigger the exodus of more impoverished Mexicans heading north to the U.S. Furthermore, if the trade war with Mexico can't be avoided due to Trump's impossible demands, if Mexico retaliates and slaps reciprocal tariffs on U.S. imports to Mexico, that will have a detrimental effect on border states like Texas and Arizona, which are key states in Trump's 2020 re-election bid. Then, with Trump leveling insults at House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Robert Mueller on Fox News today from the hallowed site of the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landing in Normandy, we'll look into whether Mueller will testify to the House Judiciary Committee in 2 weeks, as Chairman Nadler has promised. Apparently, in a meeting on Tuesday night, Nadler clashed with Nancy Pelosi over impeaching Trump, with Pelosi saying, quote, "I don't want to see him impeached. I want to see him in prison," as she argued that it is better to vote Trump out of office and have the many cases against him as a private citizen run their courts. A former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice, Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, joins us to discuss her article at the National Law Journal on dark money and the right's judicial revival, and how Trump's Justice Department is now acting like the mob, insisting that they won't turn over the unredacted Mueller report to the Congress unless they drop the threat of impeaching Barr. Then finally, we'll speak with Gail Holland, who covers homelessness for the Los Angeles Times, where her latest article is Why L.A. County's Homeless Crisis Has Been Decades in the Making. She joins us to discuss how homelessness rose 12% in L.A. County and 16% in the city of Los Angeles from last year, in spite of the city having spent $619 million of the $1.2 billion voter-approved bond to build homeless housing. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. Joining us now, Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who's in Mexico City. He's one of Mexico's leading public intellectuals, writing biweekly columns at both the Daily La Jornada and at Proceso magazine. He also hosts the weekly news analysis Democratic Dialogues show on TV UNAM, and he is a professor at the Institute of Legal Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, and the editor-in-chief of the Mexican Law Review, and his most recent book is The Myth of the Democratic Transition, New Coordinates for the Transformation of the Mexican Regime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mill Ackerman.
Wonderful to be on with you again, Ian. It's great to talk about such important issues.
Well, thanks for joining us, but it's a pretty tense situation. I mean, it's extraordinary that the President of the United States is sort of bullying Mexico. He's tweeted out today that he's going to go ahead and impose 5% tariffs on all Mexican goods on Monday, and they will increase up to 25% unless Mexico stops the flow of migrants coming north from Central America. Now, the truth of the matter is that the United States hasn't been able to stop the flow of migrants. So expecting a poor country like Mexico that doesn't have the resources or the money and the manpower to do this. I mean, the Mexicans apparently have deployed 6,000 National Guard troops on the Guatemalan border. but that's a notoriously porous border. So Trump has conflated the immigration problem, which he, of course, he demagogues, with now tariffs. And one of the things about Trump is that he's discovered that there are two things that he can do unilaterally without having to deal with anybody else, and that is he can pardon people and he can slap tariffs on. So it's like his new toy. How is this all seen in Mexico?
Well, it's interesting to use the word surprising. Is this really surprising to anybody that Trump is now bullying Mexico? I mean, this is all he's been doing in terms of foreign relations for many years. You know, Korea, Venezuela, Europe, China. That's his way of doing things. And so, you know, that he would choose Mexico, which has always been in his sights from the very campaign itself, I don't think is much of a surprise. I think actually, for at least from a Mexican point of view, the surprising thing was that for the last year or so, since López Obrador's election, he's been actually relatively decent, at least, right? Reasonable, I would say. And that he and López Obrador seem to have been getting along. This is what we've been kind of not desiring at all, but yes, definitely expecting for a long time. And I think that there's a very clear sort of political underpinning to this. Oh, well, of course, the U.S. political situation, he's using this for electoral means to beef up his base, and you know it's very productive for him electorally to scapegoat the Mexicans, look at the enemies, attack the outside enemies instead of the inside ones. But I think there's also a political issue here in Mexico itself. You know, so López Obrador is a left-wing president. He's a progressive president. He is one of the only ones today in Latin America and is exercising very important leadership in the region and the world, I would dare to say, in terms of how to do a modern progressive style government. And so this really seems from the Mexican point of view that it's not just about migration or tariffs or U.S. politics, but it's also about Mexican politics that Trump is trying to destabilize and generate problems for López Obrador back home.
Well, how long can López Obrador maintain his stance of paz y amor, peace and love, which his critics in Mexico are saying policies of appeasement, even obsequiousness?
Well, I think that this is López Obrador's philosophy and approach in general to most issues, in particular international affairs. He goes way back to the doctrine of Benito Juarez, of the derecho al respeto al derecho ajeno es la paz, the respect for foreign rights is peace, right? And so Mexican foreign policy has always has this characteristic, and López Obrador has follows on to this in terms of, you know, he doesn't want to pick fights with foreign leaders, but reach agreements. He's very pragmatic. And also, you know, he's very aware that, you know, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act in the United States, which is the one that Trump is using to, quote unquote, justify these new tariffs, depends on the country in which you are applying these tariffs being basically an enemy, right? Being a threat to national security, an unusual and extraordinary threat to national security. And so the second López Obrador starts to, you know, threaten, attack, or just in words even, this can be used by Trump, even legally speaking, to try to justify these totally unjustified tariffs, because this is a congressional prerogative, as you well know. And so, you know, López Obrador has called on there's going to be a big meeting this Saturday in Tijuana near the border. He's bringing up his cabinet, other leading officials to, you know, speak to the American people, the United States, the people of the United States, and to Trump. But I am absolutely sure that speech will be in a conciliatory tone, and it'll be an invitation to work together, North America, for better development. And so he's doing a very good job at not falling into this provocation, this trap.
Well, he's smart, though. I mean, if you flatter Trump, he just loves you. And if you criticize him, you become a non-person. So I know he's being baited and he's under pressure domestically not to look weak. But I still wonder how long you can resist this incredibly unfair imposition of essentially making Mexico solve the immigration problem that America hasn't been able to solve.
Well, it's funny because so López Obrador is actually not under a lot of pressure to look tough with Trump, because precisely what López Obrador represents is, you know, national dignity. That was what the election was all about. So it's kind of like, you know, Nixon going to China, right? So, you know, no one doubts that, no one distrusts López Obrador's purposes. And so he doesn't need to scale up the discourse for people to trust him and know that he's going to defend the national interest. And so that plays in his favor and allows him to really use a broad range of strategies and really look for a dialogue with the United States and with Trump. My perspective from Mexico at UFI, if you allow me to ask you a question too, Ian, it's like, you know, why aren't there more protests in the United States against Trump? I mean, it seems like you guys are just kind of waiting for the next election and for some miracle to happen that Trump is not going to get reelected. Well, you know, we hope so, but maybe he will. I mean, where is that, you know, groundswell of protest and human dignity against these kinds of actions by the American people?
And again, we're speaking with John Ackerman, who's in Mexico City. He's one of Mexico's leading public intellectuals, writing biweekly columns at both the Daily La Jornada and at Proceso magazine. He also hosts the weekly news analysis Democratic Dialogues show on TV UNAM. And he is a professor at the Institute of Legal Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, and the editor-in-chief of the Mexican Law Review. And his most recent book is The Myth of the Democratic Transition, New Coordinates for the Transformation of the Mexican Regime. Well, it is extraordinary. The day after his inauguration, there was a spontaneous demonstration of millions of women, both here in the United States and around the world. But there hasn't really been any organized, particularly on the part of the opposition party, the Democrats. They obviously were hoping that Robert Mueller would make it easy for them, but they didn't anticipate that the Attorney General would be so pernicious in the way that he spun the whole thing and turned it around into something that listed 10 counts of obstruction of justice. He turned that around into an exoneration of Trump. So there's a bit of a battle going on. Nancy Pelosi basically was under pressure from the House Chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler, who wants to impeach Trump along with a lot of Democrats. But Nancy Pelosi is basically saying, look, I don't want to impeach him. I want him to go to jail. You know, just beat him in the election. And once he's out of office, then he's going to be hauled before God knows how many courts. And he'll be out of there in an orange jumpsuit. So that's what's going on here. Your point's well taken. And I certainly don't want to defend the passivity of the American people in the face of this horrendous criminal who's also a traitor.
Right. Well, that's just the perspective from Mexico. I think there's or an expectation and the hope, at least, that we'll find there'll be some allies within the United States, not just the 30 million people of Mexican heritage, but the rest of the people in the United States, knowing that these tariffs are not just going to hurt Mexico. Actually, in the first place, the first people are going to hurt is the people in the United States, because, you know, the first step will be the increase in prices, and this will affect the U.S. consumers. And then, of course, this will probably reduce demand, and that'll affect Mexico, and then Mexico will put on their own tariffs on U.S. goods, which, you know, what can Mexico do to the United States, this big global superpower? But it turns out that, you know, actually the United States exports to Mexico $300 billion a year. So, you know, this could take some serious toll on the U.S. economy. You're already in a trade war with China. Is this something that really is interesting of the United States to have this kind of battle with their southern neighbor? I don't know.
Well, that's where it's counterintuitive, and some people think Trump's bluffing because it makes no sense. But a lot of what he does doesn't make any sense because he doesn't know what he's doing. He just is a reality TV guy coming up with a daily stunt, and he's constantly throwing red meat to his base. And the border has become the gift that keeps on giving for Trump. You know, and I think this will go on for years. By the way, the militarization of the border and making it a kind of a flashpoint, but the insane part of it is, one, even the Texas senators like Cornyn are saying, please don't do this because it's going to destroy our economy, and the Democrats will pick up Texas, which is, you know, would put them over the top in terms of the Electoral College. Also, other swing states like Arizona will be incredibly impacted if Mexico retaliates. But from your point of view, in Mexico, if Trump really goes to the mat and you got 25% tariffs, and he's going to destroy the Mexican economy. And guess what? more people will be emigrating north.
Exactly. That's the bottom line here, which he should understand, that, you know, if he pushes the gas all over the bottom, this is just going to create a situation which would lead to a mass migration. You know, during the between 1996 and 2005, those 9-10 years, about 500,000 Mexicans crossed the border every year. In the last 10 years, this has gone down drastically in terms of Mexican migration to the United States. It's now at 100,000-200,000, something like that. And now the new migration is from Central America, right? But Mexico has actually stabilized, has steadied out over the last few years. And if we go into this trade war, it's just going to go right back up to the old level. So it's going to be totally self-defeating. So, yeah, I think he's bluffing. So I published this Monday in La Jornada newspaper, my column, basically saying, you know, the name of the article is Trump's Empty Threats, right? Saying that he could not possibly bring this all the way, and he's just, you know, threatening. Maybe he'll put that 5% on Monday, and then he'll try to pretend that he's being victorious by new actions done by the Mexican government, like this, you know, National Guard deployment. I think, you know, it would be definitely suicide for him to actually follow through to the end on this.
But in terms of stopping the emigration from Central America, it's happening because these countries are unlivable. Honduras is run by a criminal and a drug dealer, and the gangs are rampant there, as they are in El Salvador, and Guatemala is a narco democracy. So wouldn't it make more sense to make life more livable in these countries, which you could do for pennies on the dollar? So What little investment the United States has made in trying to restore civic society in these countries, Trump has cut those funds.
Exactly. And López Obrador, Mexico's president, has a plan. This is exactly his plan. He's not just saying no. What he's saying is, first, we agree that we need sort of an ordered migration or through migration process, but we have laws in Mexico. They actually have a very good migration law, which forces and requires the authorities to respect the basic human rights of migrants, regardless of whether of their citizenship. And saying, I need to apply my laws, I need to have a humanitarian approach to the migrants. That's where I'm drawing the line. But I do have a proposal in terms of development in southern Mexico and Central America. He has a whole strategy set up of setting what López Obrador calls, you know, curtains of retention of migrants, so that they don't have to go to the United States in order to get a job. So he wants to do a big development program in the Yucatan, another big development program in near Oaxaca and the Istmo de Tehuantepec, which is the skinniest part of Mexico. And he is inviting, and also, of course, in Central America itself, in Honduras, in El Salvador, to work with those nations. And his invitation to Trump is for Trump to, you know, put together kind of a Marshall Plan, right, to bring real development to Central America, southern Mexico. And this would provide the people of those regions a right to stay where they are, because most of these migrants are forced migration through violence, through poverty, as you have been pointing out. Very few of them are just, you know, going on adventure because they want to. No, I mean, this could be stabilized in the short to medium run with a massive investment program in Central America. But Trump, of course, is not listening to reason in this case.
Well, I wouldn't count on Trump dealing honestly with the Mexicans, because one, he likes the border as an irritant to mobilize his base, and also signaling to the white working class that he's their champion, and the idea that the Democrats only care about brown people and black people, that's the subtext. But the other aspect is that he's using, as I mentioned earlier, he likes tariffs because it's something he can do unilaterally, just like pardons. But he also likes tariffs because he's making money out of it. He's basically in a position to reward his friends and punish his foes and enrich his family. And he's giving all kinds of exemptions to his friends from these tariffs that he's placing on China and now on Mexico. And there was actually a pretty good piece in the New York Times about it. And Paul Krugman, the economist there, has been writing about it as well. So that's another aspect with this incredibly corrupt administration, with Trump being a criminal and his team of grifters in the Congress. You can't discount the fact that tariffs are also a racket which Trump can exploit.
Yes, that's an excellent point. That to somehow imagine that he's interested in general in the well-being of the United States is something it's a hypothesis which is not necessarily confirmed by the evidence. Right? Maybe he's just interested in enriching a small group of people and his friends and buddies, and that this is what explains his erratic behavior. In that case, it's very difficult from Mexico to deal with it. I think López Obrador is doing a good job. He's being firm. He sent a letter to Trump saying that he's not going to be pushed around. Of course, if these tariffs are applied, Mexico will enact equivalent tariffs on different products, of course, because they're different ones go each direction. But there will be equivalent amount of tariffs placed on those goods coming from the United States. And this is not peanuts. The United States and the Mexican economy are very much integrated, for better or for worse, since the implementation of NAFTA in 1994. And so it's not something that's going to be easy for either side. So I really would like to make a call to the United States population and politicians on the right and the left, or whatever your ideological persuasion is, to work together with not only Mexico but with the world to bring institutions back into the fore and democracy, because these are really kind of dictatorial tendencies.
Well, just in closing, the talks are going on today with Mexican Foreign Minister and Pence and Pompeo, and Trump is saying that something pretty dramatic could happen. We've told Mexico the tariffs go on, and I mean it too. So there's the carrot and the stick there. Trump also criticized the Republican senators who almost unanimously are against his tariff plan, and he said to his own Republican senators have no idea what they're talking about when it comes to tariffs. So that's the final report. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Ian. A pleasure and an honor as always.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with John Ackman, who is in Mexico City. He's one of Mexico's leading public intellectuals, writing biweekly columns at both the Daily La Jornada and at Proceso magazine. He also hosts the weekly news analysis Democratic Dialogues show on TV UNAM. And he is a professor at the Institute for Legal Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, and editor-in-chief of the Mexican Law Review. And his most recent book is The Myth of the Democratic Transition, New Coordinates for the Transformation of the Mexican Regime. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the clashes between Nancy Pelosi and Chairman Nadler, who wants to impeach Trump, whereas Pelosi apparently said, I don't want to see him impeached. I want to see him in prison. Nos manejan mal. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Gimme, 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 gimme todo el poder so I can come around to joder. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Gimme, 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 gimme todo el poder so I can come around to joder. Dame, 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 dame todo el poder. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief for the U.S. courts. And she has an article with Caroline Fredrickson at the National Law Journal on dark money and the rights judicial revival. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thanks, Ian. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And today at the very solemn ceremony at D-Day near the graves of at least 2,500 Americans who died on that day 75 years ago, storming the beaches on Normandy,
President Trump took the opportunity in an interview with Fox News to describe the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, who was also at the ceremony, as a disaster. He says, Nancy Pelosi is a disaster. Okay, she's a disaster. And then he went on to trash Robert Mueller. Let me tell you, he made a fool of himself, because what people don't report is the letter that he had to do to straighten out his testimony, because his testimony was wrong. So this is, of course, a pattern that Trump has been exhibiting, tweeting petty insults to people while meeting with the Queen of England. So that's nothing new. But nevertheless, the idea that this decorated Marine who served in Vietnam while our bone spur president said on Howard Stern that his Vietnam was avoiding catching VD from the many women that he bedded. So he's criticizing somebody who Trump is not worthy to shine his shoes. So what's your sense of where we stand with the Justice Department that you know well? Because I cannot believe that the Justice Department of the United States has been turned into a kind of mob operation operating on mafia principles, where basically they're saying to Nadler and the Democrats, we'll give you the full unredacted Mueller report if you back off from impeaching the Attorney General Barr. I mean, that is what's happening as we speak, is it not, Lisa?
Well, as you've set forth there, Ian, it's just one sort of just outlandish, outrageous thing after another with this president and his administration. There's just no sense of our real history, of the real history, and of propriety and of common practice. And I think there's also just a fundamental, I mean, ignorance is one way of describing it, but it certainly goes beyond that, because you're seeing the sort of tools of power, the levers of power in our government being redirected to advance the vanity of this man, Trump, whether it's the idea that there would be a battle, you know, a ship of our Navy moved or hidden to protect this vain president, this man who has such cruelty in his remarks about other people who have served or have served our country, whether in the armed services or in public service or otherwise. And to see the Justice Department really turned into just a tool for this president to not really live up to its goals and its mission with the way that Bill Barr is directing the agency, and to try to see, just to have the idea of impeachment be some sort of bargaining chip that the president wants to somehow use in order to allow Congress to get access to materials that it has an absolute right to have access to, consistent with history and the precedent in the Watergate investigation and more. It's just appalling. I've sort of run out of adjectives. My thesaurus is already well worn, but I feel like I run out of adjectives to describe how outrageous, outlandish, how appalling their behavior is, how much they disregard the limits in the Constitution and the prerogatives, particularly of Congress. Obviously, Congress has authority over impeachment. And the idea that this administration, this Justice Department, would be acting in this way is astonishing and low and base.
Nevertheless, though, Lisa, what I find extraordinary is that CNN just did a poll that finds a majority of Americans think that Trump's going to get reelected. And there was a very contentious meeting on Tuesday night with Nancy Pelosi and the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Gerald Nadler. Nadler wants to proceed with investigations leading to impeachment. Apparently, Pelosi said, I don't want to see him impeached. I want to see him in prison. And she was making the argument that instead of impeachment, Pelosi prefers to have Trump defeated at the ballot box and then, as a private citizen, prosecuted for all of these extraordinary career of crime that he had, which was ironically, he ran for president to promote his brand, as Michael Cohen pointed out in his testimony, and thought it was the greatest branding exercise imaginable, and then accidentally got elected, and his previously disgraceful and criminal career is now being scrutinized for the first time. Although I imagine both the CIA and the FBI have a massive file on Trump. So given that crime seems to pay, thuggery seems to pay, we can't just spend our time wringing our hands, Lisa. What's going to be done? What's your sense of how to fight back here?
Well, I'm not, I on the question of that poll, I'm not sure. I mean, certainly my reading of that poll is it's not that a majority of people want him reelected. It may be that a majority of people fear he'll be reelected or think that he will somehow, because of, you know, obviously because of the way that the Electoral College is so distorted and more. You know, I think it's clear we've got 18 months before this next election, and there's a lot of work to do just on basics of democracy in terms of getting people registered to vote and making sure people understand how vital it is to vote, that it's not just, it doesn't, it's not the case that it doesn't matter, that your vote doesn't matter. We know that people who are very wealthy definitely vote. They're not bypassing that chance, and there's a whole effort that's been put forth by the GOP to make it harder for Americans to vote. That goes back, way back into the past when one of the fathers of the far right, Paul Weyrich, who has since passed away, but Paul Weyrich talked about how the right doesn't want more people to vote, that the right loses when more people vote. And I think that that was true then in the early 80s when he was bringing together the Christian right and the far right, and it's the same today. It matters for people to vote, and it matters for our planet. It matters for our rights. It matters for having an economy that holds people to pay their fair share and not just us working people. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of work to do. And there's also something of a cult effect at work where you have some 30, 35% of the population, many of them are Fox viewers, who either are, you know, sort of being actively misled and also are actively sort of spreading disinformation in support of Trump, lies that basically Trump has propagated about his opponents, you know, deceptive claims about virtually everything. And so you have, I don't think there's any chance to really pierce that border, basically, that seems as though there's going to be 30, 35% of the American people who want to follow Trump despite his obvious failings. But I think that there are many more people who do not see him as representing their interests and see him as someone who's corrupt, someone who has degraded the office of the president more. And I hope that the voices of people across the country turn out to reject him and to remove him from office. In terms of Congress, I think Congress has to pursue that investigation. It absolutely has to do so. It has to get that evidence out to the American people, as many people as possible, especially because of the deceit being propagated by Fox and being peddled by Trump and attacking Mr. Mueller, lying about the investigation, claiming he's exonerated, claiming this is a witch hunt and more. All those things are lies that Trump just repeats as he breathes, as if, you know, it's just nothing to him to lie that way. So Congress has a huge role in public education. There's no good legislation that's going to pass this Congress. McConnell will never let any good bills through in the Senate. He's the Republican leader of the Senate. What Congress has to do is to tee up the case of the American people so they're ready to vote their consciences in November of 2020, in my view.
Well, General Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, is now saying that he will be subpoenaing Mueller within 2 weeks. And my sense, Lisa, is that the real cover-up, and, you know, Nancy Pelosi mentioned the cover-up and Trump went ballistic, but the real cover-up is Trump himself, that the people around Trump are covering him up. They're covering up the fact that this man is completely off the wall. He doesn't know what he's doing. He screams and shouts at everybody. He's ignorant. He doesn't listen to anybody, doesn't read anything. Anybody that's dealt with him over the years, over the decades, businessmen that I've talked to say, you know, within a minute, you can't stand this guy. All he does is talk about himself. He lives in his own world. He is clinically narcissistic to a really pathological degree. So that's what's going on. If you could get a camera inside the Oval Office and the American people could see who their president really is, he'd be over in a heartbeat. So, and everybody around him hates him, including Kellyanne Conway, all these people that work with him, Don McGahn, anybody, because he treats people so badly. It's just, he's a disgraceful human being. So to my mind, the man who was brought to power by reality TV and by free media, about $5 billion the mainstream media gave him in free advertising, could be brought down by reality TV. And that would, to my mind, is, of course, hearings, televised hearings. The very thing that Trump is fighting tooth and nail. All these rejections of subpoenas are about not wanting people to go on camera to the American people like Michael Cohen did. So that, to my mind, is where the real battleground is. So do you see any way, I mean, if you get Mueller on camera, it had better work. I mean, my sense is that the Democrats have got to hire some really smart television programmer to figure out how to televise this slow motion impeachment, you know, from, you just mentioned, it's 18 months away. So you don't want to blow your wad too early, surely.
Well, I think you raised some really important points there, Ian. I think that it is one of the reasons why the Trump administration, why Trump and his minions are fighting the subpoenas and testimony so hard, because they know that it's hard to erase from your images. Images of people testifying about these things, really revealing Trump to be who he is, talking about the mountain of evidence that indicates that he committed a number of crimes and should be held fully accountable for them. I think that having that be broadcast is important. I think thinking about how that story is told visually is important, especially when you have all this grandstanding by these House members who are so subservient, so willing to say anything to protect Trump, anything to defend him. They're willing to ignore any truth, basically tell almost any lie in defense of the guy in the White House. It's sort of shocking how you see so many people on the right bend over backwards in service or loyalty to this man who shows no loyalty to anyone and has no loyalty other than to himself and to his own aggrandizement. But I think it is a visual story that's got to be told. Obviously, there has been, you know, a mountain of words written in the press and in books about Trump and how unfit he is for this job and how he has really debased the office of the president, how he's wrecked our legacy on human rights in the world and is disregarded by almost everyone in every world leader who isn't a dictator or isn't dictatorial. And so, you know, there's a lot of stories that have to be told over these next several months for people, more and more people, to wake up to what's happening, and also to wake up to think about where we want to go as a country, what we want our country to be like, what the values we do hold are, and how we can address the enormous challenges we face in terms of the climate changes that are underway, the opportunities that presents in terms of other investments in a greener economy, what having a nation that's so diverse means, and really recognizing our diversity versus playing these racial politics the way the Trump administration does. I think there is a lot to fight for, a lot that we believe in that is being trampled by this man who's so venal, and in many ways is so cruel, as his policies on immigration and more reflect. And so I think that the challenge is that it's a marathon and not a sprint. And I think there's going to have to be a lot of work next year to really make sure people who think they don't have a stake or maybe didn't vote or aren't registered are registered to vote across the board, and that we can try to envision together how we can make our country better and not just have it be a slogan on a hat printed in China to hide Trump's hair when he's out in the wind.
So just in the last minute, Lisa Graves, just touch on your article with Caroline Fredrickson on dark money and the right's judicial revival. There is a relationship between Leonard Leo, the head of the Federalist Society, who's responsible for putting all of these conservative judges on the Supreme Court and on all of the federal benches. He sits, as you point out, he sits at the center of an almost $250 million network of dark money groups working to fill our courts with men and women, mostly men, who will roll back the clock on our laws and our democracy all the way to the robber baron era. So what the Federalists are and what Opus Dei, the secret Catholic society, which there's a great deal of evidence that Leo belongs to that. I'm not sure about Barr and about the other people they put on the court, like Scalia, Thomas, Alito, Roberts, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. But the point is that they're kind of cast, in a sense, as the perfect candidates for the values of this secretive Catholic ultra-right group, Opus Dei. And it's extraordinary to think how successful they are. They got Scalia previously on the court, and then Thomas, Alito, Roberts, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. That's the current conservative majority. They have this peculiar ideology of Catholic fundamentalism in terms of patriarchy and being zealously against abortion. But they also believe in the most extreme form of laissez-faire capitalism. And that's what we have. I don't understand the connection between laissez-faire capitalism. I could do with patriarchy, but I'm not sure about the social issues that seem to obsess so many people in this country. So that, to my mind, is where some investigative journalists have to really start digging. It's so extraordinary to think that the conservative majority on this court all represent a very, very thin sliver of the full spectrum of religion in this country. The idea that they all belong to a kind of right-wing Catholic cult is just mind-boggling. Do you think anybody's going to really tie these threads together? Because to my mind, what Barr is doing in rescuing Trump's presidency, I don't think he cares about Trump. I don't think Leo cares about Trump. But they want him in there because he's just rubber-stamping their list of judges.
Well, I think there certainly is an argument to be made for the fact that some on the right, on the far right, and I wouldn't call them conservative. I think of them as radical reactionaries. They see this president, I think, in reality as a useful idiot, to borrow a phrase from the Soviet era, someone who will allow them to do as they please with our courts and put the most extreme individuals, and in many cases, people who are truly unfit to be entrusted with the role of being a judge on our court, including our highest court. And certainly the two people who he's put on the court, Trump's put on the court, Neil Gorsuch for Scalia's seat and Brett Kavanaugh for Kennedy's seat, are two people who are cut from sort of a common cloth. And what was extraordinary about the investigative report by Bob O'Hara and Sean Boberg in the Washington Post was how they were able to tell the story of the fact that there's a very small number of people, perhaps a fewer than a handful, who are really bankrolling this operation, being spearheaded by Leonard Leo, who in his day job is the vice president of a federal society, and his other job is the guy who's basically pushing through some of these very extreme people to be in these judicial roles for life, lifetime appointments. And also how Leo has been bragging behind the scenes that we as a nation are on the edge, on the precipice of what he called a revival of the structural constitution, which is described as basically reversing a century of law, reversing major precedents protecting people's rights, major precedents involving the power of agencies to regulate corporations, and of course, because of their very narrow religious views, reversing Roe v. Wade and women's reproductive rights, but also potentially reversing even Griswold versus Connecticut and the right to privacy and autonomy that has been recognized by the Supreme Court in this past century.
Right,
and
that was about,
it's a radically reactionary agenda.
And Griswold, of course, was essentially about women's right to have contraception. So not only are they against abortion, they're against contraception. So they don't represent the majority of the American people, do they? Not even a...
That's correct, and they're not having an honest debate about it. They're not having a debate about those things through the judiciary. They send those judges up to claim the American people on TV that they're going to follow the law, just be umpires, that they're not going to change the law, when they're being handpicked by Leonard Leo for that very purpose, to dramatically, radically, reactionarily change the law and strip us of our rights, and also our rights and our democracy to regulate these corporations through federal law and agencies. And so it's extreme, and it's super troubling, and it's another reason why we can't have in my personal view, why we can't have another term of Trump to continue the hold of this extreme majority on our Supreme Court and our law.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She's served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. And she has an article with Caroline Fredrickson at the National Law Journal on dark money and the right's judicial revival.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the homeless crisis in Los Angeles, where in L.A. County, homelessness has risen 12% and 16% in the city of Los Angeles from last year, in spite of the city having spent $619 million of the $1.2 billion voter-approved bond to build homeless housing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gail Holland, who covers homelessness and poverty for the Los Angeles Times. Starting in 2005, she edited the Cops and Courts beat, wrote news columns, and covered higher education. A series about college construction abuses that she wrote with Michael Finnegan won a 2012 Investigative Reporting Award from the Nieman Foundation. A Los Angeles native, she has worked for USA Today, Copley News, and LA Weekly, and her latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Why LA's County's Homelessness Crisis Has Been Decades in the Making. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gail Holland.
Thank you.
So there is a crisis, and it's actually getting national attention here in Los Angeles, and homelessness has risen 12% in Los Angeles County and 16% in the city of Los Angeles from last year, in spite of the city having spent $619 million of the $1.2 billion voter-approved bond to build homeless housing. So is that money being well spent?
Well, I think time will tell. We haven't seen a single project open yet, and we don't know how successful it will be. It's definitely the as far as the housing piece of their strategies, it is the consensus of the experts on homelessness that they're going down the right road. But I'm not sure where homelessness has been solved, because it's really quite a fundamental mismatch between what the amount of money people are able to make and the amount of money they're required to spend on their housing and utilities and other costs to stay inside.
Well, one doesn't want to blame the victims, but there have been studies that are up to, a third to a half of homeless people living on the streets have psychological or certainly health problems. Is that a big contributing factor to homelessness? Or I imagine living on the streets would exacerbate whatever problems you have, psychological or otherwise.
Exactly. I think there are, this has not been well studied to my knowledge, but in my own observations and what I've heard again from people who've made this their life's work, is that the experience of living outside of a home, which is more than simply living outside of a home, it's you're excluded from your community in many ways, and in many cases you're reviled and rejected by the people around you, is a much more deeply rooted trauma than people might think. And Los Angeles, I believe, is paying for its neglect of this issue over the years, because it's not like homelessness just erupted. There have been homeless problems on Skid Row downtown, in Hollywood, in Venice Beach for literally decades. And there was no rush to deal with the problem when it was at that level. And now it's a much, it's not simply a bigger problem, it's a more complex problem. Because, among other things, what you mentioned, the mental health problems that and substance abuse problems that might have developed on the street, and the physical health problems of the people on the street are also great. There's a lot of older people. I mean, of all the things that I've seen trying to cover this, the most shocking thing to me has been to see quite older people, which I naively thought, well, we have Social Security, who have just grievous wounds and are living in a tent or on a bedroll in the street.
So, Gail Holland, some people blame Ronald Reagan when he was governor here back in the 1970s for sort of emptying out people that were in psychiatric care and dumping them on the streets. And I'm sure that is not a fair description. So what do you know about the genesis of it? I know that's essentially what you've written about in your latest article at the Los Angeles Times, why L.A. County's homeless crisis has been decades in the making.
Well, I think you're overemphasizing the mental health issues as a driver of homelessness. It really is an income inequality and a housing cost issue. And I think that the mental health system is not the fact that the hospitals were closed. It's the fact that the system was hollowed out. And that's only one of the systems that have been hollowed out in the intervening decades. Clearly, nobody that Ronald Reagan may have contributed to putting out on the street, the idea of closing the mental hospitals was not completely his either, and it was supported by a lot of liberals and non-Republicans. That's just one system that's been underfunded and hollowed out. The foster care system is a big driver of homelessness for some reason that I don't fully understand, but have seen a lot. People who grew up in foster care don't transition to making a living successfully. And there's been attempts to address this by extending, you know, people say things like, well, didn't your mom, you know, when you first went out and got your first job and got fired, weren't you able to go home? And foster kids aren't. And those are all real things, I'm sure, but it seems to be something more profound. The criminal justice system is a driver of homelessness, particularly on Skid Row. People get out and have their own problems, mental, whether it's actually mental illness. It's just the trauma of being in prison and possibly rejection by family that might help them make a transition, and just a lack of places for them to go or jobs that are available to them after they have that on their record. So there's multiple systems that have expelled people into the streets, that do expel people into the streets. And then I guess one might also point to drug rehab and substance abuse treatment, which I'm not sure exactly what the statistic is, but I think most people who successfully rehab go through rehab multiple times. So between many of those times, they're back on the street.
Well, we started out talking about the $619 million that have been spent on homelessness through the $1.2 billion bond from, what was the proposition, HHH?
Yes.
So that was the biggest driver, I think, that you mentioned in that long list of factors, Gail Holland. That is that income inequality and the fact that there isn't any affordable housing. And these latest statistics are pretty alarming in Los Angeles County.
Right. Oh, but I forgot to mention the one other system. In California, both the HUD in general, at some point we declared public housing to be a failure, and failed to, you know, attempt, you know, made a transition to this rent voucher with the idea that one shouldn't concentrate poverty, that it leads to bad outcomes for people. And the idea was that these rent vouchers would take the place of public housing and subsidized affordable housing. But it's another transition where the remedy was never fully funded. And at this point, people with rent vouchers are having a hard time to finding a landlord or an apartment that will take them. Because in addition to this federal disinvestment in housing, there's also been the end of the redevelopment agencies, which did used to produce more affordable housing than I believe we are outside of this money for homeless housing. The housing, the money for just regular affordable housing has really dropped off.
Well, we
that's another system that was hollowed out. You know, basically it's the panoply of the social safety net.
Sure. Well, we mentioned that in L.A. County, homelessness has gone up by 16% in this last year, but it's worse in Orange County. There's been a 43% increase in homelessness there. In San Bernardino County, it's been up 23%, and in Riverside County, it's up 22%. So across the board, that is the problem. So how much of the money that L.A. voters initiated for this to solve this problem, you know, other counties don't have it. So would that suggest that at least some progress has been made here in L.A.?
Well, yeah, the money is better than no money.
Right.
Again, the fruits of this haven't appeared yet. And I think really right now is the first time that some of the programs that are being funded or the strategies can be looked at and evaluated, because the money has at this point been on the street or out there for people to spend for just over a year. So I think, you know, some of the strategies may not be working. It may be time to switch course on some of the things. I know one program that at least initially they reported kind of poor findings is called rapid rehousing, and the idea that there are people out there who just need a few months to get back on their feet, a few months of, you know, rent deposits and rent and utilities and all that until they can get jobs again. And that hasn't proven to be overly successful, and many of the people that were in that program, not many, but some of the people in that program have ended up back on the street. And that's one of the big findings from this year. Last year, the analysis that was offered by the homelessness authorities was that the reason that the homelessness, although they said there was a very tiny drop last year, hadn't been ameliorated to a greater extent was the inflow of new homeless because of the lack of affordable housing and rent vouchers and everything. But this year, the inflow of new homeless, according to their data, is flat. It's the same as last year. Now, of course, that's still a problem because it's however many became homeless for the first time this year on top of however many became homeless for the first time last year and still haven't found housing or haven't found stable housing. But I think it would be important at this point also to find out how many people are helped by some of these programs, but it's not enough or it doesn't take.
Well, Gail Holland, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and I think we need to do a follow-up. There's so much more to talk about, but I appreciate your time.
Certainly. Thank you for the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Gail Holland, who covers homelessness and poverty for the Los Angeles Times starting in 2005. She edited the Cops and Courts beat, wrote news columns, and covered higher education. A series about college construction abuses that she wrote with Michael Finnegan won the 2012 University Reporting Award from the Nieman Foundation. And she's a Los Angeles native and has worked for USA Today, Copley News, and the LA Weekly. And her latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Why LA County's Homelessness Crisis Has Been Decades in the Making. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Bye.